Coming up on Philosophy Talk, skepticism.
They say seeing is believing, but the senses sometimes deceive us.
So how do we know that they don't always deceive us?
That's a deep and fundamental kind of skepticism, that we know something only if we have good evidence for it.
Can you prove right now that you're not dreaming?
I've had dreams where I've asked myself, am I dreaming? And decided that I wasn't.
Do we really know anything?
I think that I really do know there's a table here that I'm sitting in front of, not just that it's useful for me to believe that.
Our guest is John Greco, editor of the Oxford Handbook of Skepticism.
The skeptic doesn't challenge your knowledge of how things appear to you. It's challenging your knowledge of how things really are.
Skepticism, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the lovely Stanford campus.
And they migrate from that oasis of thought to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. Our topic today is skepticism, and I've already begun to weigh in on that. And let me also remind you that we're now ready to have you download podcasts of our program as well. We've finally gotten to the bottom line of that long-term agreement. So, John, skepticism, what are we going to talk about today? What's the issues we're going to discuss?
Well, the main focus of our program will, of course, be philosophical skepticism, these big worries that philosophers have about whether the future will be like the past or whether we're alone in the world or in a matrix or a brain in a vat. But I think we ought to start by pointing out that skepticism in the ordinary sense is a very good thing. It's something we really try to instill in philosophy. It's the opposite of credulity. It's encapsulated in our own slogan for this program.
Yeah, question everything except your intelligence. So look, having a questioning frame of mind, you know, subjecting putative arguments to skeptical scrutiny, that sounds like a darn good thing. But, you know, how do you get from that very useful common sense skepticism to this thing that philosophers do that just runs rampant? You know, you end up with philosophical skepticism, doubting science, the senses, even the possibility of self-knowledge, everything. You just swim in the sea of doubts through skeptical arguments. How do you get from the one to the other?
Well, you start off with this good frame of mind. Who am I supposed to believe, O'Reilly or Olbermann? Who should I believe about global warming, Al Gore or Michael Crichton? And then you say, well, how do I decide? Well, I read the newspapers, I read books, I look at the internet. Then you say, but why do I trust those things? And then step by step, why do I think that this whole framework of information I seem to have is really produced by intelligent beings at all? And pretty soon you're a Cartesian skeptic. You say, how do I know I'm not just in the matrix, a brain in a vat, alone in a world run by an evil demon?
This sounds depressing. This sounds really depressing. But look, you make it sound so extreme, but it really is by small steps. I want to just emphasize what you said there, because you start out, you think seeing is believing, right? So I can believe what my eyes tell me. There's a chair there. But then you think, well, sometimes I hallucinate. Sometimes I'm merely imagining. So I can't always trust the senses. Can I distinguish the times when I can and I can't? Oops, turns out no. So I can't trust my senses ever, really. So then what?
Yeah, there's these kind of two big routes. There's the Cartesian route. Can I trust my senses? That leads us to worry about, well, he worried about whether he was in a world with an evil demon. We worry about whether our brains in vats or trapped in a matrix. And we say, well, at least we can trust science. But then David Hume says, well, all of science is based on the premise that the future will be like the past. But nobody's ever lived in the future. So how do we know that the future will be like the past?
Right, exactly. And the rationalists believe in a priori powers of reason to know the world. But the skeptic comes along and says, yeah, right. And gives all kinds of arguments against that. You can't trust the senses. You can't trust science. You can't trust reason. I mean, so we can't do anything. Let's just end the show there. It's over. We can't know anything.
Well, let's not do that. As an alternative, let's go back to basics and ask what's really involved in the skeptical, debunking, non-credulity type of mind, that frame of mind that we value so much in philosophy.
And to help us do that, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, traveled to Los Angeles to talk with a professional skeptic. She files this report.
The truth may be out there, but a skeptic wants proof. Aliens? Yes, there might be aliens. In fact, I'd be amazed if it turned out we were the only intelligent life form in the universe. That doesn't make it true. Just because I think there probably is doesn't mean that there is. And so we just have to ask for the evidence in each case.
Michael Shermer is director of the Skeptics Society and publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He holds a PhD in the history of science and is a columnist for Scientific American.
We're sort of the Ralph Naders of bad ideas, consumer advocates for science. It's our way of kind of doing a form of science education by looking at what isn't science, or what's bad science, or voodoo science, or pathological science, or non-science, and using those as a way to look at what science is and how do we know that anything is real.
I asked him how modern skeptics differ from the original skeptics, the ancient Greeks.
The advantage we have over the ancient Greeks is that we have this empirical, experimental method, actually going out and checking to see if it's true or not, rather than just using armchair philosophies, thinking things through, logical syllogisms, those sorts of things, which are fine, but don't take you far enough.
Michael Shermer and alternative medicine guru Deepak Chopra have debated each other publicly. Chopra makes a charge of skepticism today that was also made of the ancient Greeks, that skeptics don't really believe in anything.
People often equate it with cynicism or nihilism, we don't believe anything. Well, of course, that's not true. I mean, it's just an approach to claim. So there's global warming skeptics, and I used to be one, and I'm no longer a global warming skeptic. I've been converted by the data, so I guess that makes me a global warming believer. Or, in other words, you can be skeptical of a claim, or you can be skeptical of the skeptics of a claim. We just want to know the way the world actually is.
Shermer debates all types of people, intelligent designers, psychics, proponents of ESP and UFOs, and all very publicly. He tries to keep things polite, but his skepticism doesn't always win him friends.
I did have one incident where after a lecture, a guy got up right up in my face, and he was really quite aggressive. He was a very religious sort of fundamentalist, and so I said unto him, "Go forth and multiply," but not in those words.
And yet, Shermer wrote a book called The Soul of Science, where he argues that science and spirituality are very compatible.
I mean, if you want something that makes you feel humble, wow, go stand up inside the dome of the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson, right above L.A. here, is where Hubble discovered the Big Bang, that the universe, well, he discovered the universe is expanding and that it's much bigger than we thought, and that it must have had an origin, and it makes me feel very humble and spiritual.
The work of the Skeptics Society is never done. It continues to examine extraordinary claims, both new and old.
I mean, it's possible there's a Bigfoot, but until somebody produces a body, then it's reasonable to be skeptical, right?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by John Greckel. He's professor of philosophy at St. Louis University. He's editor of the forthcoming Oxford Handbook of Skepticism. John, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Hi, John. John Perry here. I've got a question for you to get things started. What do you think the deepest kind of skepticism, of philosophical skepticism, is, and what are the arguments for it?
In brief compass.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, what the thing about, as you said, philosophical skepticism is that it's radical skepticism, right? And I suppose one of the most radical sorts of skepticism is skepticism about the external world, which roughly means skepticism about anything that exists beyond our own ideas or beyond appearances, right? So yeah, I think that's a deep and fundamental kind of skepticism that I can know anything outside my own thoughts or how things appear to me, that kind of thing.
How does a philosopher get him or herself in the frame of mind of doubting whether there's an external world out there? I mean, you bump into it, it rushes in on your sensations, you know,
right.
You try to fly and you can't because, you know, gravity won't cooperate. There's a world out there and it constrains. How does a philosopher ever get himself in the frame of mind of really, truly, seriously doubting that?
Well, you know, I guess from my point of view, a philosopher ought not to get himself ever into the frame of mind of really seriously doubting that sort of thing. What makes skepticism interesting to me is not that there are skeptical people, myself or someone else, but rather that there are skeptical arguments. That's what's interesting about skepticism, right? That you've got these arguments that start from assumptions or premises that look pretty innocent, even benign, and then you sort of follow this the line of reasoning, you end up with this incredible conclusion that I can't know that I have two hands, or I can't know that I'm sitting at a desk.
Now, I've got an argument that there are really no famous philosophers that were really skeptics, because if you were really a skeptic, why would you publish anything? I mean, you're just kind of publishing it for, you know, making your own ideas, to tell you about your own ideas. So there may be real skeptics, but I bet they didn't publish anything.
Well, then we wouldn't know that they were there, right?
Right.
But John Greco, help me, take me through one of these arguments, starting with a simple, irresistible premise and concluding with an astounding conclusion.
Okay, good. So I'm going to look at an argument that gets a lot of attention. It's familiar to us from Descartes' First Meditation. I'd say there are probably three important points here, and again, you know, very briefly. The first point is that we know something only if we have good evidence for it, that good reasons, and you know the sorts of reasons that favor our claim to know over some other claim.
Okay, that sounds good. I'll buy that.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good, right?
Yeah.
The second point is that our evidence for our beliefs about the world comes down to our experience, the way things appear to us. You know, so either directly or indirectly, I believe things about the world because I seem to see things that way or hear things that way, that sort of thing, right?
Well, I'll buy that one, too.
Sounds good. So now the third point maybe needs a little bit more motivation than the first two, but the gist of it is that our experience or the way things appear being the reasons or evidence we have for our beliefs about the world really doesn't amount to very good evidence or reasons for the things we believe. There are other possibilities out there. There are alternative explanations for why we might have the experience that we do, other than that things are as they appear to us. So the evidence basically doesn't support the conclusions that we naturally draw
from the evidence. What are these under explanations?
Okay, so we've got some sort of commonplace explanations like, well, you could have just the same sorts of visual appearances that you're having now, even if you were dreaming. So we've all been fooled into thinking, for example, that we were somewhere where we weren't because we were only dreaming such a thing.
So. John, I heard, or I didn't hear him, but I read Bertrand Russell put this in a very good way once. He said, look, suppose that you had a dream that picked up every night where it left off the night before.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, how would you know which was the dream and which was the waking life? So maybe you resolve conflict. Maybe you had a job offer from two different places, and so you go to one place, but at night the dream takes over. How would you really know where was a dream and where was reality?
That's a kind of question for our listeners, too. Look, you're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're talking about skepticism, and I want to know from our listeners, are there modes of knowledge, modes of believing that you think are immune to skeptical arguments that you just trust absolutely, that no philosopher could talk you into being skeptical about? Tell us what you think they are, and we'll see if we can do it. Give us a call at 1-800-525-9917.
And have you ever had a dream that you actually did mislead you, so the next day you spent part of your day thinking you'd done something you hadn't done? I mean, I must admit that has happened to me. Does it happen to anyone else?
So, John, look, it sounds like, okay, so John Greco, you said, so there are these appearances. We're inclined to trust them. We're inclined to believe that that our belief should be grounded on evidence and argument. But then we find out, you know what? The appearances aren't a reliable guide because while the world appears to me thusly, it could really be some other way, right? It appears to me that the sun goes around the earth, but the earth really could be going around the sun. It appears to me that I'm awake, experiencing, but it really could be. What's the sense of that really could be? I mean, really?
Right.
Could it really be? Or is that just, I'll pretend it could be. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
right. Well, good. So this is an important point to get clear about, because sometimes the skeptical arguments can sound quite crazy and not worth paying attention to. And one important thing to realize here is that the skeptic never claims that this dream possibility is true. So for example, when Descartes considers that, well, God is powerful enough, I think, to create me and the world and everything in it, certainly God is powerful enough to give me these visual experiences and other sensory appearances that I'm enjoying now, and yet they don't correspond to anything that they seem to correspond to, right? Well, the skeptic doesn't claim that we are in such a position, right? The skeptic is only making the more pedestrian claim that, look, your evidence supports your claims about the world only if it rules out these other possibilities.
Well,
so it's not the...
Yeah, that's a pretty high standard that skeptic is subjecting us to. And in a bit, I want to ask you if that's a reasonable standard. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is skepticism. Our guest is John Greco from St. Louis University.
And we'll go on to probe the reasons for and against philosophical skepticism, but how about your own skeptical attitudes? Why do you trust certain news sources and certain sites on the internet and not others? Are these habits of mind something that can propel you into philosophical skepticism? Have you ever been really bothered by the big problems of skepticism? You can join us by calling us toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Skepticism, common sense, and philosophical. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
This is Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is skepticism. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Look, folks, all this stuff comes at you these days in the modern world saying, believe me, believe me. It comes from all corners and all sources, and it can't all be true. When do you turn on your skeptical filter? How do you decide what to believe and whom to trust?
The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. You can believe me, 1-800-525-9917. You can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is John Greco from St. Louis University.
John, let me review a little what we've talked about. It comes down to the skeptical dynamic seems to come down to this thing that if you've got an alternative explanation, you have to take it seriously. And that's something we use in all our reasoning. My favorite example is when I was a kid, our mother put out some cookies that she was weren't for my brother and I. They were for a party she was having. And my brother ate a cookie, then he took the crumbs and smeared them all over my face. It was my older brother. And she came in and blamed me, right? She leapt to the most plausible explanation of the evidence she had. But then I gave her an alternative explanation. I said, Tom smeared the cookie over me and he ate it. She didn't know what to think then, but that's the principle. Look for an alternative explanation. And how do we block these alternative explanations short of the point of saying, how do we know we're not brains in a vat or creatures from the Matrix? Do you have a good stopping point?
Yeah. So skeptical arguments just on that same footing as John's mother's cookie hypothesis?
Well, they pretend to be, right? The skeptical argument wants to start from assumptions or premises that we find plausible and that we find that we use in our everyday judgments about what makes sense to believe, what's reasonable, what's not reasonable. And then the skeptic tries to show us, look, if we apply those norms consistently, we end up with a skeptical conclusion, namely that we don't know the sorts of things that we typically claim to know.
Now, I heard a little skepticism about that move of the skeptic in your voice. Was I right in here? You said the skeptic claims to be. That was a way of distancing yourself from the skeptic's move.
Well, right, because I assume that the argument has to go wrong somewhere, right? I mean, I guess I think of the skeptical arguments like maybe Zeno's paradox that there is no motion, right? We have this argument for us, before us, and the premises look true, and every step in the reasoning seems valid. Do I then think, therefore, there's no motion? No, I think, well, there's got to be something wrong with this argument, right? So when the skeptic claims to be using only the sorts of norms and standards that we already endorse, you know, in the concepts we have in use, I'm skeptical about that claim.
That's because somehow. Well, wait a minute. You're just cheating. That's because you're antecedently convinced that there's knowledge out there. It's like you're not open to the very possibility that there isn't any knowledge. That John, in the end, the skeptic's right. You just don't know anything.
Well,
isn't that just a prejudice on your part?
Well, I think let me say that I want to take this as a methodological prejudice, right? I think that's what we should do. Our methodology should be to think, well, there's got to be something wrong with an argument that has the conclusion that I don't know I have a hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's try to put our finger on what the mistake is. And that's where the real philosophical work comes in, and that's what philosophers end up disagreeing about, because there's no consensus about what exactly is the mistake that the skeptical argument is making.
Well, let's see what some of our callers think about this. Are you folks out there moved by skeptical arguments? Do you sometimes put on your own skeptical hat? Give us a call, 1-800-525-9917. And Marjorie in Richmond's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marjorie.
Hi, good morning. I love philosophy, and well, one morning, you know, I was supposed to be at my job, first day there, and so therefore I thought I was there, and then I woke up and I was in bed.
So you had that Descartes experience.
And I was just thinking about that the other day, and then I hear you guys talk about it. Well, so, you know, I was thinking about that experience. Every now and then it comes up
to me. Did you keep the job? Did you explain to your boss why you were late?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Good thing I was sleeping in my clothes. So, I didn't have to get dressed. I could run right down there. Huh?
So, Marjorie, did that convince you to always wonder whether what you think you perceive you're really just dreaming about?
Once in a while I do that, and that reminds me of like lucid dreaming. Like if you remind yourself every day, is this a truth or is this a dream or is it real? And then sometimes you can wake up in your sleep, I heard.
So thanks, Marjorie. John, so we've got a real life, you know, person there who's lucid, falling into the Cartesian worry. So
yeah,
it's not just a made up worry.
And I've had worse dreams than that. I've had dreams where I've asked myself, am I dreaming? And decided that I wasn't. But then I woke up eventually and found out that I was.
That sounds like a philosopher's dream.
that sounds like a professional hazard, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But look, let me ask you something about your methodological take. You said, I don't quite remember how you put it, but you want to presume, kind of as methodological presumption, that we do know stuff. And then you want to meet the skeptic's challenge by saying, well, how could it be? What is knowledge such that we could know this? Or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what skeptical arguments give us are these wonderful heuristic devices for highlighting our sort of pre-theoretical common sense assumptions about what knowledge is, what it would take to know certain things, etc. And then the skeptic employs those assumptions to try to show us that those assumptions lead us to skeptical consequences.
One of our listeners makes an interesting analogy, and what you're really making here is a methodological point, which I agree with. It's an important thing in philosophy. You have some words that make a distinction for you in your everyday life. I know this, I'm not sure of that. But lots of times in philosophy, arguments tell us we can't make distinctions that we thought we could make, and what philosophers do with that, then they hold the argument up and try to figure out what's wrong with it. He reminds us of the Sorites paradox. So you say, we make a distinction between people who are bald and people who are not bald, but accept the principle that removal of one hair never makes a person bald. If they've only got one hair, they're already bald, and if they got a head full of hair, removing one hair won't make them bald. And if you accept all those premises, and you get, if you remove one hair at a time, you'll never make them bald. That's a great paradox. Thousands of pages have been written about it. Important mathematics and logic have come out of it. So similarly with skepticism. You're going to tell me that there's not a distinction between things I know and things I don't know. What's your argument? And it's really the investigation of that argument where the philosophical work gets done.
I agree with that, but I'm more skeptical than either John's are about about this methodological principle, because it seems to me, I'm going to make a confession of faith. I think the skeptical arguments are airtight. The best skeptical arguments are airtight, and there's no escaping them, and maybe we don't know anything. But then you know what I'm willing to do? Say, well, big deal. We don't know anything. We still believe lots of stuff. You know, unless you think we can't believe something unless we know it, then who cares what this? I mean, so give up on knowledge, but save belief. So I'm not. What do you think about that, John Gregel?
Well, I think it's too quick. I mean,
it longer if you want.
No. I mean, what I mean is that. I would not want to go there until I thought I had to. I'd want to save knowledge until I thought there's no way to do it. And so I guess that is a difference between the skeptical arguments and, say, the paradox about motion or the paradox about baldness. I suppose we should keep open, in some sense, the possibility that these arguments are correct, and then we revise. But I'm not willing to do that now. Yeah, one reason is I think that the concept of knowledge plays extremely important roles in our practical and theoretical lives. We use the concept of knowledge to do things, and And it seems to me that we should be able to save those uses.
Yeah,
if at all possible.
I take your point, but I think we could talk about that at some length, whether we could do with mere reasonable belief what we now try to do with knowledge. But, you know, our callers are aching to join us here. 1-800-525-9917. And Phil in Brisbane's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phil. Philip.
Oh, thank you. There's a philosophical term, and I just cannot remember it. Perhaps you could refresh my memory, but it involves the notion that nothing exists outside of the self or the perceptions of the self.
Solipsism.
Solipsism, that is it.
Are you a solipsist?
Well, no, I'm skeptical of that when I think of things like an infant's need for mother's milk or the fact that if that were so, I could easily achieve the serenity of the Buddha, but instead I get road rage and crash into someone or assault them and go to jail. And why would I do such a thing if why would I make such a choice if nothing exists outside of myself?
Well, Philip, wait a minute now. There's one thing about what there is outside of yourselves, and there's another thing about what you take to be outside of yourself. It's not because there is something outside of yourself that you get road rage. It's because you believe there is. Now, the question for the skeptic is, are you justified in that belief? So you can believe, and those beliefs play all the role, but the skeptic asks the question about the justification. John, do I got that right, John Greco?
Yeah. Yes, I think that you know what one of the points that makes the skeptical position seem more plausible and seem more natural is to make that distinction between appearance and reality, right? And the skeptic isn't challenging, or at least the type of skeptic that we're talking about here doesn't challenge your knowledge of how things appear to you, or it doesn't challenge your knowledge of how things seem. It's challenging your knowledge of how things really are, right? Do we know how things really are as opposed to how things seem to us?
So if I accept a skeptical challenge, the position I'm in is, well, I know that if I don't do what I take to be picking up a sandwich and put it in what I take to be my mouth, I will have very definite pangs of hunger. Now, maybe there's really a sandwich and maybe I really have a mouth. Maybe I'm just a mind. Alone in the universe, except for an evil demon that wants me to think those things. But if I don't want to have that pang of hunger, it doesn't make much difference. Is that the attitude we should take?
You know, guys, this all gets very complicated, doesn't it? I mean, I don't want to bring all the history of philosophy in here, but this all gets very complicated. Because the idealist, who kind of wanted to say, there's nothing, in a way, but us and our ideas, right? There's no external reality, no material reality beyond our ideas. They thought one of the reasons they defended idealism is because they thought the only way to avoid skepticism is to be an idealist, right? Because if there's an external world over there and your ideas over here, skepticism is going to be inevitable. How could our ideas match up to that world? And there's no answer to that.
That was Berkeley's idea. He was going to avoid skepticism by not making this a theory of double existence, so there was nothing to be skeptical about. But in the end, he's got a lot to be skeptical about. He thinks that the world is real insofar as it manifests God's intentions. But how does he know about God's intentions? I don't think idealism solves the problem. What do you think, Greco?
Well, first of all, I think that it's a testimony to how powerful these skeptical arguments are that philosophers have been driven to such amazing positions to try to avoid the skeptical conclusions. That's the first point. To solve the problem of knowledge of the external world by claiming, well, there is no external world, that's sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, it would seem, isn't it? But a lot of philosophers have been pressured in that direction.
And they've been pressured in that direction because they think it's the height of intellectual courage and honesty to have to go in that direction. These problems are so hard. Right. Hey, we've got a caller, Tina in Richmond, who'd like to join this conversation. Tina, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
This is really pertaining to an earlier caller, too, I think a little bit. I'm just curious about the relationship between skepticism and ethics. What has skepticism said about ethics, you know, through the history of philosophy, or just basically is there a skeptical take on ethics?
Thanks for the question, Tina. John Greco, what do you think?
Well, we've been talking about skepticism about the external world. But there are different kinds of skepticism depending on what is the scope of the skepticism. So someone might think, well, I don't have a problem with knowledge about things outside my mind, but I do have a problem when someone claims to know a moral truth, claims to know that something's right or something's wrong. I don't think that knowledge of that sort is possible. So a kind of moral skepticism would have a different scope than external world skepticism. But again, usually there's arguments behind the position. It's not that someone's just claiming, oh, we can't know anything about right from wrong. It's that there are good reasons for thinking that we can't know anything about
right from
wrong.
Give us a feel for why somebody might become a moral skeptic, briefly.
Well, I suppose. Just let me mention one of the earliest ones would be Thrasymachus, right? He says, look, all this moral talk is gobbledygook. It's just what's right is what's in the interest of the stronger. That's a kind of moral skepticism,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I think, one very natural way to get yourself into a kind of moral skepticism is to think about the plurality of moral opinions, the plurality of moral views out there, and you start thinking about the sorts of reasons we give to convince each other when we find ourselves in a disagreement. Those reasons almost never do convince, so on some fairly straightforward standard, the evidence or the grounds that we have for our moral opinions are falling short, right?
So that sounds like you're a moral skeptic. Well, if there is no sort of absolute right and wrong, then you must be a moral skeptic. But why not be a kind of relativist about right and wrong? What's right for me really is right for me. What's wrong for you really is wrong for you. Mm-hmm. I'm not an absolutist, but I wouldn't thereby be a skeptic, would I? Does the moral skeptic make the mistake of thinking you have to be an absolutist?
Well, I think, the relativist, someone who takes a position of moral relativism is somewhat analogous to the person who adopts anti-realism in the face of skepticism about the external world. It seems as if you might be throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because what we wanted to know was what's really right. Can we know what's really right or really wrong, not just what does some society consider to be wrong or what do I think is wrong or what's wrong for me?
Yeah, it looks on balance like moral skepticism's a little easier because we have a lot of disagreement. There's not that much disagreement about whether there's a table in front of us. We can usually come to agreement about those basic kinds of facts, but moral facts,
They're pretty dicey. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing skepticism of many different varieties with John Greco from St. Louis University.
Are you gripped by any of these skeptical challenges that we brought up that philosophers worry about? Why or why not? Do you think philosophers are just spinning their philosophical wheels, or do you think we're getting at something worth knowing by worrying about whether we're just brains in vats?
The point or pointlessness of philosophical skepticism when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'm against it, and I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.
I'm John Kerry. Our topic is skepticism, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Our guest today is an expert on skepticism, John Greco from St. Louis University. John, I want to ask you a question about, here's a way of getting at this, whether philosophers are just spinning their wheels about this stuff, and whether the common person should worry about these skeptical arguments. I sort of could grant you, if I'm in the philosophy laboratory and the skeptic puts up these arguments, making me doubt whether I have a hand, I might be moved by them. But if I'm in the bar in everyday human life and somebody says, here's some arguments that you don't have a hand, I think they're crazy. I mean, those arguments just seem out of context in the barroom, even if they have a point in the philosophy classroom. What do you think about that?
Well, if the skeptical arguments are anything like the way I've described, then it might be that people in a bar typically won't care about why the skeptical arguments go wrong. But I don't think the skeptical arguments will be any less convincing in the sense of trying to put your finger on what exactly the mistake is, right?
Wait a minute. Yeah. You said they won't care, but I'm making more than a claim that they won't care.
Okay.
I'm making claim, given the kind of stakes and standards of, what's relevant to our discussion, that operative in the bar, they shouldn't care. They're rationally entitled not to care.
I see.
Because the context kind of sets the standards for them of what's a pointful argument.
Right. And I think there is something right about the idea that certain standards we have for what's going to count as knowledge or what's going to count as good evidence or reasons are going to change with context. They might go up or down with context. But I don't think that that can be the whole answer, or at least you need to cash out quite a bit more how that's going to go. And I suppose one reason why I don't think this would be the whole answer is because I think some skeptical arguments don't seem to rely on overly high standards.
Well, let me give you an example, see how you react with that. I think this is from Fred Dretzky. So you're at the zoo and you're looking at the zebras and somebody says, are those zebras? And you say, yeah, those are zebras. And they say, are you sure? And say, yeah, I'm sure. Do you know that those are zebras? Yes, I know that those are zebras. And then they say, how do you know those aren't mules with stripes painted on them? Well, when they say that, you say, well, I guess I don't know, given that. Now, what's happened there? Has this possibility that you hadn't thought of, has that changed you from knowing to not knowing? Or is it the case that you didn't know all along? I'd be inclined to say, well, assuming they were zebras, you did know that they were zebras. And then a doubt came along and you weren't so sure, so you didn't know. So knowing is kind of based on the context of alternative possibilities.
That's right, right. And the possibility of a painted mule there is playing the role of the possibility that I'm in the Matrix or a brain in a vat or the victim of a Cartesian demon, right? So I guess I want to say that, yes, there's something right. There's something right about saying that those skeptical possibilities aren't relevant, that we don't need to deal with them in order to know. However... there's still a lot of, if that's the way to go, right, if that's a good strategy for meeting the skeptical argument, there's still a lot of philosophical work to be done there because we want to have some sort of understanding of why a possibility is irrelevant.
Since you're not in San Francisco, you're probably not aware that we've got this band of zealot Dretzky fans who've been going around actually painting mules. And so it is a real live possibility here.
Well, let's let another caller into this discussion. Terry in San Jose. Welcome to, I think you may be the first caller from San Jose, Terry. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. You
Hello.
There, Terry?
Hi.
What's your comment or question?
Yeah, I just wanted to understand why you think that truth is the goal of knowledge or your philosophical exercise as opposed to something like usefulness. Take the zebra example. If you're sitting up outside the zoo, how useful is it to understand that it's a zebra versus a painted mule?
So you think, Terry, do you think that if we don't acknowledge, if we go for usefulness rather than truth, the skeptical arguments don't have much force? Is that your point?
No, I think skepticism is a great way to look at it, but that we also have to remember the perspective. For instance, you know, the bald question, is it understanding bald as different from understanding the hair as a, it's kind of a trees versus the forest issue.
I think I've got you, John. John Greco, what do you think?
Well, you know, again, there is a pressure to retreat away from a claim that, for example, we know the truth, or the claim that we know how the world really is, as opposed to what's useful or how things appear to me, or something like that. There is that strategy that you get pushed to very quickly to try to retreat to something like that in the face of the skeptical argument. But if we do retreat like that, I think we have to be honest that we're really giving up our sort of common sense notions about our relationship to the world, right? I mean, I think that I really do know there's a table here that I'm sitting in front of, not just that it's useful for me to believe that there's a table here
but John,
to sit in front
John,
of.
But, John, I don't see this as a huge retreat, and I think, I'm going to thank Terry for the call. I think it's a great question. I don't see it as a huge retreat, and I think it's a kind of hubris for you not to be willing to quickly go to the retreat. You think, I know, and then you think, well, look, in face of these skeptical arguments, let me fiddle with the knowledge of knowing so that I can preserve this intuition that I know, and that knowledge is honorific. But you know what? Why not just say, I believe. And let me finish. And it's the possibility remains open that despite my belief, I'm wrong. But nonetheless, I believe in the face of this possibility. Nonetheless, I have reason to believe. I have more reason on this side than on that side. And all I ever get is kind of the preponderance of the weight of reason for or against belief. And if none of it ever adds up to knowledge, well, who cares?
But I mean, what more would it be to add up to knowledge? I mean, you're assuming a certain picture of knowledge. Is it so reasonable? It seems to me once you've got a good solid case that it's more reasonable to believe that the future is like the past, then that the future isn't like the past, or that there's a world out there instead of just living in a matrix, won't you have solved the skeptical problem?
Well, I think you will in some ways have solved it, but I don't know what knowledge is. And all these endless debates about knowledge, is it justified true belief? Is it just reliable? I think those could just come to an end.
Hey, Ken, let me remind you something. Philosophy pays your salary, and philosophy philosophy is endless arguments.
Yeah, I agree.
Right?
Well, John,
so let's not knock the endless arguments.
John Greco, what do you think? I mean, I think give up knowledge, have a response to the skeptic, and then not engage in these endless debates about knowledge is this, knowledge is that, knowledge is standard, relative knowledge, you know? Because I don't know how you're going to solve any of those anyway.
Well, one problem there, Ken, is that I think the best skeptical arguments don't really trade on overly high standards of what's going to count as a reason or what's going to count as knowledge. I think that some of the best arguments really give you a stronger conclusion that I don't know, or I don't know with absolute certainty. They give you the conclusion that my evidence doesn't count in favor of my belief any better than for some alternative. So, for example, Hume is wonderful at identifying circles in our reasoning. Well, if Hume is right that our evidence for the external world or our evidence for future matters of fact is circular, well, circular reasoning is no good at all. No, it's not that it doesn't meet some high standard.
I grant you that you could have a form of skeptical argument, a very powerful form of skeptical argument that undercut all reasons to believe, right? And that would be bad. If we could have arguments that undercut all even comparative reasons to believe over here rather than over there, then I'd say we're in a terrible stew. But if they only undercut reasons to the claim of knowledge, the status of a belief as knowledge, well, while leaving reasons to believe intact, then I don't care about the skeptical arguments because I've got all I need. Yeah. Now, those other ones, I think they're much harder to make out, the ones that, as Sextus Empiricus said, the only thing to do is suspend judgment, right? Never affirm. But I think he believed that you can't have a reason to believe unless it counts as knowledge. So I don't think his arguments actually work to force you to merely suspend judgment. Do you get the point I'm making?
Right. So there are really two questions. One is, you know, do some of these skeptical arguments work if we're not just worried about knowledge, but worried about say justified belief or reasonable belief? Do they really challenge reasonable belief, or are there any good ones out there that challenge reasonable belief as opposed to knowledge? And I think there are. I think that some of Hume's arguments, claiming that our evidence for the world, for example, or our evidence for scientific explanations, is largely and very sort of viciously circular.
Yeah, we've got time for one brief last caller in here. That's Dan in San Francisco. Very briefly, Dan, you're our last caller.
Hi, I just want to say you're going to fall into Hume's despair unless you have a trait called faith, and it doesn't have to be faith in God or any kind of religious thing, but faith in like maybe the light of reason, like Descartes or something. That's your only real answer if you're looking for the noumena behind the phenomena.
Well, I don't know. Thanks, Dan. John, what's your last thought about the faith as the answer to this?
Well, it depends on what you mean by faith. If by faith you're opposing that to knowledge or opposing it to reasonableness, then really you're just drawing a skeptical conclusion, right? You're saying the skeptic's right. My belief's not reasonable. I don't know anything. I just have to go on faith. There might be another point behind that comment, though, and that is that there are different sources of knowledge and reasonableness than just the one the skeptics are letting us have.
Maybe
that's a different thing.
On that possibility, which we have no time to explore, I want to say thanks for joining us, John. It's been great having you.
Thanks for having me. I loved it.
Our guest has been John Greco, professor of philosophy from St. Louis University, editor of the forthcoming Oxford Handbook of Skepticism.
And we also want to thank all the callers and emailers we didn't get a chance to talk to and read the email of.
John, so where's your head? You got some books you want to tell us about and some thoughts you've
settled
on?
Well, so first, just to continue with Dan's thought, I do think in a way the word faith has these religious overtones. But if you look at Hume says, well, you know, ultimately, we just have to believe in a pre-established harmony, that our ideas, the way our mind works, is set up to mirror the way the world works. And I think something like that is right. Descartes tries to prove that we have an instrument that's useful, that is capable of gaining knowledge, and he bases that on on this argument for God, but I think maybe what we have to have faith in is just that evolution or God or somehow we've been given something useful for knowledge. So I think Dan has a real point.
Yeah, I think he has a point, and I'm still thinking, yeah, knowledge, we don't know anything. It's always fallible, but we have belief, and we can go on accumulating reasons to believe without hubris, thinking our reasons may subsequently be overridden and we have to start over.
Well, since we have so little hubris here, we want to remind you of some great things you can read from the history of philosophy. First, the value of modest skepticism, common sense skepticism. Look at Plato's Euthyphro. Sextus Empiricus outlines Epicureanism as great, but two modern classics, I mean modern meaning since the 17th century, Descartes' Meditations and Hume's Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. That'll give you everything you need to know to be skeptical.
Oh, everything you know. Those will give you everything you know. Plus, also, go visit our blog, because I've written a developing blog entry there about this stuff. The blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we turn to the fastest brain in the vat, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there seem to be two strands of skepticism, the philosophical, in which knowledge of truth is impossible, or at least hasn't happened yet, and scientific, which questions claims by subjecting them to systematic investigation. This latter skepticism led to that great American pastime, debunking. Houdini, for instance, would reveal the tricks of so-called psychics and mediums. Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken were fond of exposing silly beliefs. Martin Gardner wrote Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science in 1952, which debunked dowsing, belief in flying saucers, psychokinesis, and Dianetics, among other things. It launched what's been called the modern skeptic movement. The Amazing Randi is perhaps most famous of these, exposing faith healers, mind readers, and guys who say they can bend spoons with their mind. There's also the late Philip Klass, who made ufology his skeptical bailiwick. Admiring skeptics dubbed him the Sherlock Holmes of ufology, but in 2003, ufologist Jerome Clark called Klass, quote, an obsessed crank who contributed little to the UFO debate except noise, pseudoscientific speculation, and character assassination, unquote. Randi and Klass were members of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, or PSYCOP, formed in 1976. Some of its founders began investigating the claims of French statistician Michel Gauquelin, who had come up with something called the Mars Effect. Using statistics, he found that champion athletes are more likely to be born when the planet Mars is in certain positions in the sky. If verifiable, this would seem to be scientific proof of astrology's validity. PSYCOP researchers did their own study, which led to an embarrassing scandal. The details are still being discussed some 30 years later, but the basic story goes that PSYCOP's study found that Gauquelin's study was valid. But they did not publish that study. Instead, they did a follow-up with incorrect statistics, which disproved the study. In protest, PSYCOP member Dennis Rawlins wrote a whistleblowing article for the October 1981 issue of Fate magazine. He wrote, quote, I am still skeptical of the occult belief PSYCOP was created to debunk, but I have changed my mind about the integrity of some of those who make a career of opposing occultism, unquote. Philip Klass, in turn, wrote an article debunking Rawlins' debunking of his fellow debunkers. There followed resignations, intemperate phone calls, capitalized letters, excessive use of exclamation marks and italics. Phrases like obnoxious, glory-starved showboater appeared. In 1981, PSYCOP adopted a policy of not conducting research. Perhaps, as one critic suggested, because even studying paranormal events confers status upon them. PSYCOP, it's been accused, is not a skeptical investigative body, but more like a special interest group. The Mars Effect, by the way, has yet to be disproved. But if you believe it's true, you're probably an idiot. I gotta go.
Wow, Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.